This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast with me, Jessica Crichton, on Thursday, the 19th of November. Good morning. Welcome to the programme. And what a programme we have coming up. Singer-songwriter Nadine Shah joins us to discuss her new album, Kitchen Sink. It explores themes of fertility, tradition and identity, all told through the stories of women at different stages in their lives. And I'm really looking forward to having a chat with Nadine a bit later in the morning. But first, let's talk about the environment. Now, there's been lots of focus on Woman's Hour this week about our 2020 power list and the 30 brilliant women who feature on it, who are all trying to make a difference for our planet. Some of the women on the list are young, very young, actually, in some cases. And that's because young people are one of the key driving forces behind fighting for action on the climate crisis. But what is it like being on the front line? And how do the younger generations want to change the way we, who perhaps aren't as young, think about environmental issues? Well, let's talk to three of those young women on our power list. They are Maya Rose Craig, Michaela Loach and Holly Gillibrand. Good morning, ladies, and welcome to the programme.
Good morning. Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Also joining us is Sophie Howe, who I think is one of the most intriguing jobs I think I've ever known. Sophie, you are the Future Generations Commissioner for Wales, where basically you hold the government to account on behalf of people who haven't been born yet. Incredible. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'll get come to you a bit later in the morning, Sophie. But first, I just want to speak to Maya Rose, Michaela, Holly. I'm really interested to know how you became environmental activists. So just tell me a bit about how you got involved. Maya Rose first.
I always find this a really difficult question to answer, just because in my opinion, as a young person, I've always been really flooded with news that the planet's going to end, essentially. Like, I've always known about climate change and stuff like that. And I think I've, from a very young age, wanted to do something about it. So since I was 11 or 12, I've actively been doing things to help with the environmental movement. And I think for me, it's always felt incredibly important that I at least tried to help with all of these issues that we're dealing with at the moment. But it's always been a really massive part of my life as someone who cares about the environment and cares about nature.
Wow. So you started from a very young age. What about yourself, Michaela?
I think, like Maya, I find this question so sometimes quite difficult, because it's not like there was one point at which everything changed. But for me, I think when I was younger, especially, I was more engaged with issues around like racial justice and especially with migrant justice. And that was kind of the lens with which I entered into the climate movement. It was realizing that the climate crisis is going to be the greatest forced displacement that the world will ever see, and it also intersects and connects with institutional racism. And that's when I was like, oh wait a minute, the climate crisis, and through a lens of climate justice, which like sees it as a social justice issue, we can actually help all these other issues. And I think for me, that's how I got involved, really.
And what about yourself, Holly?
I think for me it was less of a moment, more of a process, because I've always loved nature. I've always wanted to go outside and always loved seeing wildlife. And then I reached a point, I think when I was 13, that I started to open my eyes to all the issues it was facing. And then I suddenly thought, I can't just not do something because nature, what I've always loved, is threatened with all of these different problems, these issues. And I couldn't just stand back and not do anything. So yeah, it was 13, I think, when I decided I was going to do something. And I think it was after I went to a Chris Packham event and he was talking about all these things. And yeah, it just snowballed from there.
Wow. So 13. You're 15 now, Holly, so you're still at school. Just tell me a bit about what it's like balancing your schoolwork with your activism work and also having a public profile.
Well, if someone has figured out how to balance activism with schoolwork, could they please let me know? It's very difficult because on one hand, I mean, I like school sometimes. I love learning about, you know, science and maths and English. But at the same time, it sometimes feels like it's all a bit pointless because, you know, you go onto the news and all of these awful things are happening. And then you think, why am I wasting my time with schoolwork when I should be doing activism? So it is very difficult. And then, of course, you've got to think about, you know, staying grounded, spending time with family, with friends, and just trying to have a bit of normality in your life. So I don't think there's really... Yeah, I'm not quite sure if I've managed it yet, but, you know, it's very difficult, but it's just something as an activist you have to deal with.
You mentioned there, Holly, spending time with friends. What is that like? Is it a worry for you having to try to fit in? Because I presume most of your school friends aren't into the environment as much as you are.
It depends because most of my friends are quite aware of what is going on and they do care about it. But I think there's a gap between caring about it and actually doing something about it. Mm. So one of my friends, she's been striking with me since I started and she really cares about it and she's doing a lot of stuff to do with the environment. But then I've some of my other friends, yeah, they care about the environment and they know what's going on, but they're just not doing something. And I think that is a major problem with young people who do know what's going on, but just aren't taking that next step.
You mentioned striking. Just tell people about what you've been doing, because you actually leave school every Friday, don't you? I'm sure your parents are very happy about it.
they're not that... They do support me. So yeah, I've been striking from school every single Friday since January 2019. So yeah, this Friday must be week 93, something like that. I'm losing count. But yeah, so I leave school every Friday for an hour. And I've also been doing various other things. I'm a young ambassador for Scotland The Big Picture. So I've become very interested in rewilding. And I support Heal Rewilding as well, which is a new organization that's just started in England, trying to buy land and rewild it. And yeah, I've just kept building on stuff. So I look at different issues and yeah, I just do what I think what interests me as well as what I think I need to do.
Wow. You are juggling an awful lot, Holly. Maya Rose, I'd like to know about the traditional perception, I guess, of environmental activism and how people tend to perceive it and how perhaps now with young activists like yourself, that perception is changing.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, just because we're in a very transitional period, in my opinion, for the environmental movement at the moment. So I think historically, or I say historically, even like 3 or 4 years ago, there was definitely this image that a lot of people came to mind for a lot of people, where it was sort of almost very 60s, like very white, liberal, middle class, tree hugging hippies sort of thing. And I think that's how a lot of people genuinely felt about the environmental movement. Which has historically been very exclusionary, just because even though a lot of other communities, other groups of people really care about the environment and they also, you know, they care about the state of nature, I think it feels like a kind of space where they wouldn't necessarily be welcome or they're not the type of person, I suppose, who should be part of a movement like that. And what's been really interesting is I think that this new upswell of youth movement in terms of environmental activism hasn't really carried that same baggage, in that this Fridays for Futures movement, the youth strikes, just in general, the young people that care about nature aren't the traditional types to an extent. And you still have a lot of things where a lot of people that are doing environmentalism are still very white, they're still very middle class. But I think that that image that the movement has carried around for decades, that's been dragging it down, is starting to be shed and it's starting to feel much younger and much more relevant. And I'm very excited actually to see how this new youth movement is going to go forward and try and engage with lots of different groups of people.
Now, Michaela, I'm sure you can relate to that and the movement becoming more diverse. That's a main aim, I guess, of the activism that you do and taking an intersectional approach. Tell me why you feel climate activism, I suppose, should be incorporated alongside other areas of activism like social justice, racial justice.
Yeah, I think when we talk about the movement and wanting to diversify it more, I think we need to like recognise that it's not like black and brown communities haven't been involved in the movement up until now. All of us owe the fact that we even still have a viable planet to Indigenous communities who've protected the natural world for so long and who still protect the natural world against the fossil fuel industry and so many other things that are trying to destroy it. Yeah, my work surrounds the fact that we can't separate the climate crisis and the climate crisis as an issue from social justice issues because it is interconnected. So climate justice is a principle that sees that how the climate crisis impacts people is dependent upon systems of oppression. So it's dependent upon how the social categorizations that an individual holds oppresses them, and therefore they are more likely to experience the negative effects of the climate crisis if they are already oppressed in some other way. And therefore, if these connections and intersections already exist, we can't address the climate crisis without also addressing these systems of oppression, because otherwise we're just going to end up with people still being oppressed, but in maybe without the threat of the climate crisis. And that's not a world that we should want. We should want to create a world for all people and not just a better world for like a small group of people.
So how big of an issue is this at the moment, Michaela? How much is climate change just looked as a single issue?
Well, I think I've experienced, at least in the climate movement, I've heard people say that talking about racism, for example, is diluting the movement and it takes the like message away from what we want people to focus on, which is emissions. But we can't just focus on these things, because when we focus on when we just focus on the climate crisis and don't take like an intersectional lens, so a lens that sees that systems of oppression exist in the world and that they are connected, and they're connected to all the kind of crisis issues that we see. When we don't take this lens, we open a space for oppression. So with oppression, either we're upholding it or we're like disrupting it. And if in our climate work we just focus on emissions without seeing how maybe our climate solutions are going to compromise Indigenous rights or the rights of different communities in the global South. Like, examples of this can be seen when there's people try and offset emissions by planting monoculture of trees, but that can happen in communities on Indigenous land where they evict Indigenous people from their land and compromise their rights in order to offset emissions in the traditional global North. And that's why in our solutions we have to think, how will this impact people, and how will this be interrelated to the oppressions that already exist in the world.
And Maya Rose, being that you are British Bangladeshi, and I know that you've been doing some work with a group that you founded called Black to Nature, so diversifying the conversation and diversifying access to nature is important to you. Tell me about that.
Yeah, massively. So I think it's been a really interesting journey for me, in that when I started, I run nature camps for children, especially children from minority ethnic backgrounds that wouldn't necessarily have that opportunity to spend any time in green spaces around with nature otherwise. And I was 13 when I started that project, and it came from this desire to just, I suppose, share nature with other people, because I'd grown up with it and it was a massive part of my own life. But then as I started looking into it more and doing more research, I realised that there was a much wider issue going on, where essentially the nature sector, the types of people going out into nature, the environmental movement, all were very exclusionary, and it really, I didn't understand. So I've been campaigning for about 5 years now to essentially try and make sure that all of our different communities in the UK are being included when it comes to decisions about nature and our environment. And to be honest, it's been really difficult, just because it was a very dire issue when I started. I think it was about 0.6% of the nature sector was from minority ethnic backgrounds, which was really shocking. It was the second worst in the UK, and not a massive amount of change within the sector has happened since then, although it is starting to shift. But personally, I think it's so important, not just to make sure that you have lots of different types of people, but also for the sake of the mental and physical health of the people from these communities. And the fact that, in my opinion, everyone deserves to have access to nature, deserves to have that relationship with the environment. And so I'm going to you know, I suppose carry on fighting to try and make sure that this issue is pushed through and something is done about it.
Brilliant. You started that when you were 13, you say. We're 15 minutes into this conversation and already I'm feeling inspired by you ladies. Now let's talk about social media, because social media and young people, if you believe what you're told, you'd think it's all selfies and trolling and pouting. But for many young people on social media, it has become a vital tool. And Holly, for you, I know it has as well in terms of your campaigning work, trying to reach out to people because you are from a smallish town in Scotland. So tell me about your relationship with social media and how it's helped you.
Well, I think it's been crucial for getting me from where I was to where I am now, because with social media, you can reach people who you wouldn't normally be able to connect with. And it was that initial, it was when I went onto social media that I first began to see that young people could make a difference. Because at that point, I thought that I can't wait till I grow up because then I can do something. And I just hadn't been met with this idea of young people actually doing, actually campaigning themselves. And so yeah, I went onto social media and I was just immediately gobsmacked by all of these amazing young people who are doing something. And then I realized that yes, I could as well. And so yeah, I started the strikes, I started campaigning, and I put my message out on there. And social media has, is the reason why the school strike movement and other movements like it have been able to spread so far, because young people from all around the globe can connect when in the past it would have, you would have relied on newspapers and on word of mouth to reach out like this. So yeah, I think social media is, it's thought of as a blessing and a curse, but I think for the environmental movement, it's been absolutely crucial for allowing us to spread and reach out like we have been.
Maya Rose, you mentioned earlier about the outdated perception of environmental activism, but I suppose social media has helped change that perception as well, more so than traditional media has.
Absolutely. And I think one of the really interesting things about social media is the fact that instead of in traditional media, like the news on TV, newspapers, things like that, you're able to have loads of different conversations going on all the time, which leads to lots more people becoming engaged, because it's not just, I suppose, a singular issue. There's loads of different things, like people are talking about, I don't know, the wildfires in America and Australia, people are talking about climate change, people are even talking about the flooding that's going on where I live in Somerset. There's all of these things going on at the same time, and I think it feels much less exclusionary because you can just join in on a conversation, and I suppose you're much less hyper aware of your own, I suppose, your own almost experience with the environmental movement. And I think that social media has done an amazing job of engaging people that otherwise just wouldn't be interested because of that, I suppose, really diverse spread of issues that you're able to talk about simultaneously.
Now, Michaela, as Holly mentioned, social media can be a blessing and a curse. I've been on your Instagram profile. You have over 90,000 followers, but with that increased profile often comes increased responsibility. So does it feel like a lot of pressure sometimes?
Yeah, I think it definitely does. I think also one thing about social media is that people almost feel like they have this access to you, this right to access you. And like, I don't only do activism and don't only do my social media and podcast, but I also am a medical student full time. And I have to like balance all of those things. I think I've had to like kind of reflect on my relationship with social media, because it is a gift and a curse. It allows us to access so many people, but also we have to look after ourselves in that. And I think that working out what radical self-care means and what caring for ourselves means as activists, as individuals, in this lens of social media where everyone can access you all the time and can judge every single part of your life, is something that is quite tricky, and that is something that I think all of us like learning about and trying to work on. Social media is quite a new thing. Even my following grew very, very quickly, which I think shows that people want to hear different kind of outlooks on the environmental movement, which is great. But also, I think I have had to take some time to also reflect and look after myself.
Good for you. Very important. Now, let's bring in Sophie Howe, who, as I mentioned earlier, is the Future Generations Commissioner for Wales. You hold authorities to account on behalf of people who aren't born yet. As far as I'm aware, it's the first job of its kind. So, Sophie, just tell us about how this role came about.
Well, the Welsh Government has had embedded in the legislation that established the Welsh Assembly, or Senedd as it's known now, right from the outset, a duty to sort of have due regard or to use sustainable development as a central organising principle. But I think that there was a frustration amongst particular ministers, who some of whom are really passionate about sustainable development and the environment in particular, that, you know, actually this was, you know, this resulted in a kind of report that was presented to the Assembly once a year, and nobody really took much notice of it, and it was regarded as something to be done by the Environment Department, when actually what we know about protecting the environment is it's absolutely critical what happens in the Economy Department, the way in which, you know, the Housing Minister goes about building new homes and designing and planning communities and so on, and has a really significant impact. So we wanted to look at how could we think in a long-term and sustainable way. And we were fortunate that the principle of having some legislation was agreed. And at the time, the UN Sustainable Development Goals were going through the United Nations. We drew on that. We had a national conversation about the Wales we want with the citizens of Wales, to say, what is the Wales that you want to leave behind to your children and your grandchildren? And from that, we came up with 7 national wellbeing goals, and this legislation, which has this overarching principle that all of our main public institutions, so our councils, our health boards, and significantly the Welsh Government itself, must demonstrate how they're meeting today's needs without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. And then it appoints an independent commissioner to oversee that and hold those bodies to account.
It's a very wide-ranging remit, but as you mentioned there, you're focused on the long term, whereas politics and often discussions around the climate crisis are notoriously short term. So have you met with a lot of resistance? How difficult has it been to try and influence people to think about these things differently?
Well, it is challenging because although we've got the legislation, we've still got a 5-year political term, and we've got short-term budget cycles and so on. But actually, I think the way to approach this is to not regard kind of the interests of future generations and current generations as kind of mutually exclusive. Really, if we think about some of the things that would make a really big difference, and this is where I try to focus my attention, and really interesting to hear Michaela and Maya Rose and Holly talk about the interconnections between different issues. So if we do things like invest in improving the energy efficiency of our homes, that's going to be helping us to reduce our carbon emissions targets, which is important, of course, for the climate and for future generations. It's going to keep current generations warmer, older people out of hospital in the winter months. If you're, you know, you're committed to tackling poverty, it's going to be taking people out of fuel poverty. Mm-hmm. If your interest is in the economy and creating jobs, investment in that area is going to help to create jobs. So what we need to do, I think, is to try and find those things which have multiple wins across all elements of well-being. And that's where I suppose our legislation is quite interesting, because it covers social, economic, environmental and cultural well-being, all four pillars on a kind of equal footing. And so, you know, thinking about the things that are going to be have multiple wins across those areas.
Now, I'm interested, Sophie, in this idea of how the individual can help the environmental crisis. There seems to be a lot of attention given to the fact that we should be recycling our tins and our boxes and perhaps taking fewer flights, without there being so much attention on the negative impact made by big companies in terms of their emissions. Mm-hmm. So how much do you think the focus should be on changing what big companies do rather than the individual?
Well, I think it's got to be both. I mean, in Wales, the levels of emissions that come from our manufacturing sector are disproportionate as compared to the rest of the UK. And just yesterday, I was with representatives from all of those manufacturing companies in Wales, meeting with the Welsh Government to talk about some ambitious decarbonisation plans there, and how we could do that in a way which doesn't just, you know, help us to dramatically reduce our carbon emissions fairly quickly, but also help to create new jobs in green industries, you know, particularly in the current climate with COVID and job losses and so on, that's absolutely crucial. So I think we do need to have that focus there. I think that the government do need to be showing leadership, and they do need to be creating the conditions which enable people to make sustainable choices. So we've had, you know, record low investment in public transport in Wales over a number of decades. And that means that it's really difficult for people to make sustainable travel choices. That is starting to change now because of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. And just this week, the government have produced a strategy, which I've been working with them on and providing some quite vocal challenge on over the years. But what we're actually seeing now is that that transport strategy is based primarily around reducing the need to travel. So in Wales, the government have a target of 30% home working to continue, for example, because that helps us to reduce our emissions. Then we talk about active travel, walking and cycling, then public transport, then electric vehicles. And only if you know, there's nothing else, no other solution left, should the government be investing in kind of roads and private, you know, use of private vehicles and so on. So I think that, you know, the government does have to show leadership. But I also think, and, you know, we've heard this from the young activists that we've been talking to this morning. I think that young people are showing the way in terms of many of their behaviours. So, you know, I've got a 21-year-old and a 17-year-old. They don't buy any new clothes. They buy it all, you know, through the circular economy on Depop and, you know, various other platforms and so on. They don't own a car. And in fact, you know, the patterns of young men in particular are that they're just not bothering learning to drive. They'd rather not have the hassle of that and be able to use public transport. You know, the increase in vegetarianism and veganism, you know, that's being driven by young people themselves. So I think, you know, if we could have a, you know, a pincer movement of better leadership from government and better choices from individuals, that's where I think we could make a real difference.
What do you think, Myros? Would you like to see more focus given to big businesses rather than individuals?
Yeah, I think this has always been quite a difficult question for me, in that when I first found out about essentially how large corporations have manipulated individuals into feeling like they're responsible for issues like climate change, when that's not true at all, my first instinct was to be like, oh, wow, okay, that means, you know, I need to go and fight them. I don't necessarily have to think about my own lifestyle choices. And I think every environmentalist has one or two things that they do, which are a bit like, I'm not sure how I feel about the fact that I'm doing this. And I think I was like that for a few years until I suddenly sat back and thought, like, no, but I don't want to be that person who is also contributing to an issue, whether or not that contribution actually has an impact. And so for me, it partially feels like almost a moral responsibility to try and do the right thing in terms of environmentalism. But I do definitely think that there is still this narrative of blaming people for their individual choices and suggesting that that causes climate change. Like, the one that really annoyed me was when a countdown clock was put in New York to when climate change was essentially going to tip over and we weren't going to be able to do anything about it. And it was this massive clock, and it was like essentially counting down till the end of the world. And it was like, why do the people walking around doing their shopping need to see that when they are, for the most part, not responsible for this issue? Go and put it inside, I don't know, Shell's HQ or inside Wall Street or something like that, because I think that it's so easy to push the blame back onto individual people to make them feel so helpless about this issue. And it's an incredibly harmful narrative that's not to sound very cynical, but it was entirely on purpose, because essentially when these big oil companies discovered climate change back in the, I think it was the 70s, they had their think tanks go out and start spreading misinformation about how individuals needed to make better choices in their lives, because they knew that it was going to be very poor for their businesses otherwise. And that is misinformation that has stuck around for decades. And I think it's, yeah, I think it's terrible, in my opinion. And I think we need to hold these big companies, these big corporations, much more accountable.
Yes, certainly. And of course, Shell and those other oil companies aren't here to give their side of the story. But I wonder, Michaela, what are your thoughts on that? Because do you feel there needs to be a change in focus?
I think currently there's too much of a focus on individual action. So 100 companies are responsible for 71% of all greenhouse gas emissions. 100 companies are responsible for 71% of all greenhouse gas emissions. And yet constantly the narrative that I feel like we're being pushed is that we need to make individual change in order to save the planet or to prevent the climate crisis. Like Shell the other day put a poll, as we mentioned Shell already, put a poll like asking what we were, like individuals are willing to do to prevent the climate crisis, when actually everyone was replying saying like, we're willing to stop you from lying about the climate crisis. We're willing to stop you from killing indigenous activists in Nigeria and from destroying like the natural world. I think that we do need both. We need behavior change and we need system change and putting pressure on these big businesses and these big corporations. But I think currently there's been just too much focus on the individual. And when you focus on the individual, these like people and these organizations that have so much power and are causing the most amount of damage to both people and to planet, they kind of are getting away with it. And they're almost like laughing like, oh, you're spending. And I always say to people, if you're spending more time having to go to maybe many different shops to try and get plastic free stuff, when you could use that same time to join an activism group or join a group in your community or start lobbying against these bigger corporations, then I think we need to think about like where our time is best spent. Is it best spent focusing on like more maybe ego based like change, or is it more like better spent like focusing on these big corporations? Because collective action is how we see change, and collective action means us working together and putting pressure on the systems that exist. And I just think we should like think about that a bit more.
Definitely lots to think about. And again, just to reiterate that Shell obviously aren't here to give their side of things and perhaps might disagree with some of what Michaela has said there. But I wonder, Holly, I just want to bring you back in because I'm wary of time, but there will be some people listening to this, Holly, that are inspired by what you and Michaela and Maya Rose have been saying and perhaps want to get involved as young activists, environmental activists. What advice would you give them?
So my first advice would be to connect with other young people, because if you go it alone, then it can feel extremely isolating and you'll feel like you're getting nowhere. Whereas if you connect with that wider movement and if you find people who care about this just as much as you do, then you'll be able to keep campaigning for much longer and you'll be much more effective and you won't experience you're less likely to experience things like burnout and despair. And also talk to your parents, because if you have the support of your parents and if you make your parents understand what is going on and what you want to do, it makes a massive difference. And so I feel like I'm going on a bit, but also do find your niche, do what feels right, because when we see massive protests going through the streets, that's only a tiny bit of what goes into activism. So decide, are you good at writing? Are you good at art? Are you good at cooking? And use those skills to support this movement and other movements. And yeah, don't feel like the fate of the whole world is resting on your shoulders, because it isn't. You can take time off. You can take time off and you can look after yourself without the whole world coming crashing down because you decided not to do any activism for an evening. If we join together as a movement, we can change things, but please don't go it alone, because there are so many people out there that will support you and will welcome you.
Wow. Not going on a bit at all. I was listening intently. And as I said, all three of you ladies, I'm very much inspired. To Holly, to Michaela, to Maya Rose and to Sophie Howe, Future Generations Commissioner for Wales, thank you very much for coming on the programme this morning. Now, in a moment, I'll be speaking to singer-songwriter Nadine Shah. But first, let's look ahead to something coming up on the programme next week. In a new series report, Jo Morris will be talking to four women about a secret fear, how it feels to reach the age your mum was when she died. Let's hear a bit now from Titania. And first, Rachel.
It just felt like a bit of a deadline, really. I've never talked about it, and therefore because I haven't talked about it, I assumed it wasn't an issue for anyone else. I've never heard this mentioned before. And I thought it was just me being a bit neurotic, really. Somewhere along the way, in losing my mum at the age of 40, that decision in my head was like, right, that's my timeline then. That's what I'm working towards.
It's there in your mind that you are approaching the age that your mother died or your grandma died. It's kind of an insane thought, so you kind of keep it in your head because it's wrong. I thought I was the only person. I thought it was an irrational fear that had to be sort of silenced and ignored and just tidied away somewhere safe and glass half full and all that, fine. You can have fears and worries and concerns. And speaking it doesn't make it true.
You can hear their stories in full on the programme next week and on BBC Sounds. And don't forget, if you missed the live programme, you can catch up by downloading the BBC Sounds app, or why not subscribe to Woman's Hour podcast so you never miss a programme. Do get in touch to share your views and stories as well. We are at BBC Woman's Hour on Twitter and on Instagram as well. Now, joining me now is Nadine Shah. Her new album, Kitchen Sink, explores the themes of fertility, tradition and identity. Good morning, Nadine.
Good morning. Hello.
Oh, great to have you on the programme. Before we get into our chat, I'm looking forward to it. Let's just hear a little bit from the new album.
Don't you worry what the neighbours think. They're characters from Kitchen Sink. Forget about the curtain twitchers.
Call me pretty, make your manoeuvre. 1 year younger, call me a cougar. All dressed up, think I did it for you. Make eye contact, think I adore you.
You're the beginning of everything. You're the calm in a storm. Let's trail curses renewable. They are fantasies in.
Nadine, the tone of your voice is mesmerising. It's such a pleasure to be able to listen to that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I'll use that in a quote, if you don't mind.
You can put that on your Twitter profile if you like.
I will do very, very shortly after this.
So the tracks that we were listening to there, Kitchen Sink, Club Cougar and Prayer Mat. Now, what made you choose Kitchen Sink as the title of this album?
Oh, I forget. It was that long ago. You know, so Kitchen Sink, well, a Kitchen Sink realism was like, it was a British cultural movement in the late 1950s and the early 1960s in art and film and theatre. And typically the protagonists were angry young men who were disillusioned with modern society. And I suppose here I am, 2019, 2020, an angry young woman, disillusioned myself with much of modern day society, I suppose. And then there's the connotations of the kitchen sink and a woman's role and place in the household. So I think that's pretty much where the album title came from.
You said in that sentence, angry and disillusioned. Why so?
How long have we got?
Oh, all the time in the world. Come on, let's get deep, Nadine.
Oh, here we go. Good morning. Did it start before my 30s? I think it did start before my 30s, but I noticed it more and more. When I got to 30, 31, 32, these conversations where people were openly commenting on, you know, on my life choices, you know. Nadine, why haven't you, you're not going to have a child? You know, it's time's getting on, TikTok. Genuinely, people had said to me, TikTok. All of this pressure. Many of my friends have children and it's a beautiful, wonderful thing. Having children is a gorgeous, beautiful thing. And getting married is a beautiful thing also. But the constant reminder and people's assumptions that they're allowed to have these conversations with me, it really did start to frustrate me. And there was many other things going on that people didn't know about when they were mentioning my fertility. People didn't know that I have endometriosis. They didn't know it's a very difficult conversation for me to have. And all of this kind of, it contributed to this anger, I suppose, I was experiencing at the time and anxiety. And then I started having this conversation with my friends more openly. How do you feel? Do you feel pressure to get married? Do you feel pressure to have a child? All of this. And that all really fed into that's where the album came from, really, from those conversations with my close friends.
It's a very real worry. I'm in my 30s as well, Nadine, and I think I definitely sympathise or at least relate to what you're saying. Before we listen to one of the tracks on the album called Trad, just tell us a little about what it's about, the concept and how you came to writing it, because I think that's relevant to what you've just been saying.
Yeah, that was the, I think actually the lyric for Trad, it was the first lyric that I had for the whole album. All I had written down was shave my legs, freeze my eggs, will you want me when I'm old? That was the first lyric that I had. And I just, I kind of had it sat there for a while and I kept coming back to it. And everything that I was feeling related, it's kind of all encapsulated in that one lyric, I suppose. If we're talking about the policing of women's bodies and, you know, the advertisements telling me, you know, are you beach body ready?
Let's you hear know. It. Let's have a listen now, Nadine.
Great.
What a fabulous track, Nadine. Now, these are big issues that you're discussing, you're talking about, and they're very personal. What is it that inspires you to use your voice in this way? What makes you want to put yourself out there?
I mean, I do regret it a lot of the time.
Oh, really?
Yes, because it's a bit like, my mother said, it's a bit like hanging up your dirty laundry for everybody to see.
Yes, yes.
Because it is really exposing, but... I mean, these are my stories, but they're also from these conversations I've had with other people. These are many other people's stories. And I wasn't hearing these stories being told in music. And I felt a kind of, I mean, it sounds a bit grandiose, but I found it a kind of a duty of sorts to write about these subjects.
A duty? Why?
Because I wasn't hearing it anywhere else. And I was having these discussions with my friends. And I think it's important to have these discussions in art. And I was seeing definitely in film, that these stories are being told, but in music, not so much. And especially when, you know, youth is currency, and especially in music, but it's a really sad thing in music. There are not a lot of older female musicians. Why that is, I don't know. And, you know, in 2016, we had, I think maybe four or five men in their 60s releasing albums that were in the top 10, and hardly any of women in their 60s. And I really want to hear their stories. I mean, my wish is that Amy Winehouse was still alive, and I would have loved to have heard what she would have been making when she's 60 years old, to hear her stories of what it's like to be a woman who is 40, who is 50, who is 60. And I just wanted to give my version of things.
I was talking there to singer-songwriter Nadine Shah. Lots of you getting in touch and were inspired by our chat with the young activists on our power list. Mary has emailed in to say thank you to you and the wonderful young women in your programme this morning. It gave me a sense of hope for the future, something that I've been struggling with. I'm 69 years old and an environmental activist, so no stranger to the topic. But to hear those wonderful young women reignited my flagging energy, thank you to you all. And Tina has tweeted us in to say, such a powerful group of dynamic, visionary young women. You were all pioneers leading the way. We've also had another tweet here from Fleeting Flow, who says, youthful energy always needs a cause to identify itself with. Its natural habitat is one where it can challenge or test the old order. I recall being equally exercised 50 years ago. The more we learn how to protect our sources of nourishment personally, the more extensive we realise it is. So a responsible, maturing mind will start with self-care, family, tribe care. But it seems not everyone was quite as inspired. Kumar says, whilst it's great that young people are more aware of the environment, however, these youngsters are the very people who will order goods online, which will be delivered by vans. And also, instead of striking and disrupting everyone else going about their business, why don't they use their spare time to clean up the environment and the rivers and stop eating meat? We've also had a very lovely email about the interview we did with Nadine Shah. Julie has said, just wanted to tell you that times are changing. I have made it very clear to both my 23-year-old son and 19-year-old daughter that having a family is not a path they have to take. I very much tell them to find themselves, and what comes from that is a path I want them to take. I look back on my life and felt like I had no choices, but this was my decision. Nobody really forced me into my chosen lifestyle, but I regretted some choices. But this was because I did not feel I had permission to follow another path. I really want my children to have a fulfilled life, and having a family is not the only route to happiness. Now, tomorrow on Woman's Hour, we'll be hearing from another of the women on our power list. Jane will be talking to Kate Humble. Kate was chosen by the judges for her long history of dedicated wildlife broadcasting and bringing environmental issues into millions of homes across the UK. Enjoy.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.